The cursor blinks. It is a steady, rhythmic pulse of white light against a charcoal background. The apartment is quiet except for the hum of the refrigerator and the occasional rattle of the radiator. Outside, the streetlights reflect off the wet pavement, casting a jaundiced yellow glow across the desk. There is a half-eaten green apple on a white ceramic plate. The flesh of the apple has turned a bruised, rusty brown where it was bitten. A single silver spoon rests in a glass of lukewarm water. The water is clouded with a film of dust. Julian sits in the leather armchair by the window. He is wearing a charcoal wool sweater. His hands are folded in his lap. The knuckles are pale. He does not look at the screen. He looks at the shadow of the fire escape against the brick wall across the alley. The silence is heavy. The kind of silence that suggests something has just stopped breathing. My fingers are poised over the keys. The plastic is smooth and cool. He asks if I have finished the chapter regarding the shallow grave in the orchard. I tell him the technical details are difficult. I tell him that describing the way the soil mixes with the lime requires a specific kind of sensory language I haven't mastered yet. He doesn't move. He says that the beauty of a ghostwriter is their ability to become the ghost. He says he hired me because I have a gift for the tactile. He wants the reader to feel the grit under their fingernails. He wants them to smell the wet earth. He says that if the prose is too clean, the lie becomes obvious. I type the word phosphorus. I type the word decay. Working for Julian Vance was supposed to be the pivot point. 6 months ago, I was editing technical manuals for HVAC systems in a windowless office in Queens. Now, I am in a penthouse with floor-to-ceiling windows and a view of the park. Julian is the kind of man who commands the air in a room. He doesn't raise his voice. He simply waits for the world to lower its volume to match his. When he offered me the position exclusive ghostwriter for his upcoming true crime-inspired thriller, he told me I had a dangerous imagination. He told me I saw the world in shades of gray that most people were too blinkered to acknowledge. It felt like being seen. It felt like a promotion into a higher tier of existence. He gave me a laptop, a stipend, and a key to the apartment. He told me that for the book to work, we had to live inside the logic of the crime. We had to be a team. The story is about a man who kills out of a sense of order, a man who believes that some lives are simply cluttered and need to be tidied away. We spent weeks discussing the mechanics. Julian would pace the room, describing the character's thought process, and I would translate his abstractions into visceral, bleeding prose. He praised my additions. When I suggested the killer should use a specific type of nylon cord, because it wouldn't leave organic fibers, Julian smiled. He said I was a natural. He said I had a mind for the unseen edges. I liked the praise. I liked the way he looked at me when I solved a narrative problem. It was the first time in my life I felt like an architect instead of a tenant. The apple on the plate is darker now. The brown has spread to the core. Julian stands up. He walks over to the desk and places a hand on the back of my chair. I can feel the heat from his palm through the fabric of my shirt. He leans over and reads the last paragraph. He points to a sentence about the weight of the shovel. He suggests I change heavy to balanced. He says the killer wouldn't feel the weight as a burden. He would feel it as an extension of his own arm. I make the change. My hands are steady. He tells me he has a gift for me. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a small leather-bound ledger. He sets it next to the laptop. He says these are the research notes he's been keeping. He says they are too sensitive to be kept in a digital format. He wants me to incorporate the dates and the locations into the final act of the manuscript. He says it will provide the undeniable weight of reality that the critics crave. I open the ledger. The handwriting is mine. I stare at the pages. It is my script, my slanted C's, my looped L's. The ink is a dark blue, the same pen I've used since I started working here. The notes describe the orchard. They describe a girl named Elena. They describe the exact depth of a trench dug on the night of October 14th. I tell him I don't remember writing this. I say it with a small, nervous laugh. I tell him I must have been sleepwalking or working in a trance. Julian doesn't laugh. He looks at me with a soft, patronizing pity. He says that we've had so many late nights. He says the creative process is a fugue state. He reminds me of the wine, the long hours, the way we lost track of where he ended and I began. He tells me that the ledger is the blueprint. He says he was so impressed by my initiative that he decided to let me take the lead on the logistics. He walks to the kitchen and pours a glass of water. He uses the same glass from earlier. He drinks it slowly. I flip through the ledger. It's all there. Map coordinates. Receipts for lime and nylon cord. Clipped to the pages with silver paper clips. My name is on the receipts. My signature, slightly hurried but unmistakable, sits at the bottom of a credit card slip for a hardware store in a town I've never visited. I feel a coldness start at the base of my spine and move upward. It isn't fear. It is a sudden, sharp clarity. The kind of clarity you get when you realize the person holding the flashlight is the one who dug the hole. I tell him I need to go home. I tell him I'm tired. Julian sets the glass down. He says that the lease on my apartment in Queens expired 3 days ago. He says he took the liberty of having my things moved into the guest suite here. He says he didn't want the commute to interfere with our momentum. He says he's already paid the movers and handled the transition. He tells me I'm all in now. I look at the laptop. The cursor is still blinking. The exit mirage appears as a sudden thought of the police. I think about the phone in my pocket. I think about the elevator. I think about the lobby and the doorman. I can just walk out. I can take the ledger to the precinct. I can tell them that Julian Vance is a psychopath who is trying to frame me for a murder he's clearly committed. I can explain the receipts. I can explain the handwriting. But then I see the email notification on the corner of the screen. It is an encrypted outgoing message sent from my personal account 2 hours ago. It is addressed to an anonymous tip line. The subject line is, "I can't keep his secrets anymore." Attached to the email is a digital copy of the manuscript, the one I just finished. The one where the killer's internal monologue matches the specific idiosyncratic psychological profile I developed during our brainstorming sessions. In the manuscript, the narrator describes the thrill of the collaboration. The narrator describes how she convinced a famous author to lend his name to her crimes so she could see them in print. I realize then that the manuscript isn't a thriller. It's a confession written in the first person. And because I am the ghostwriter, because I am the one who typed every word, the metadata on the file belongs to me. The IP address belongs to this apartment, where I have been living for weeks. The research in the ledger is in my hand. The cost of leaving is the rest of my life. Julian sits back down in the armchair. He looks relaxed. He looks like a man who has successfully finished a long, difficult project. He tells me that the world loves a tragedy. He says that a brilliant young writer losing her mind and turning her fiction into a dark reality is a story that will sell millions of copies. He says he will be the grieving mentor. He will be the one who tried to help me, the one who didn't see the signs until it was too late. He asks me why I'm looking at him like that. He says he thought this is what I wanted, to be famous, to be recognized, to be part of something that actually matters. I look at the green apple on the plate. It is completely black now. It looks like a stone. I think about the zero feeling rule. I focus on the mechanics. If I run, the email is already sent. If I stay, I am the one who holds the pen. I ask him what happens next in the story. Julian smiles. It is a genuine warm smile. He says that in the final chapter, the narrator realizes that the only way to truly be free is to finish the work. He says the body in the orchard is just the beginning. There are other cluttered lives that need to be addressed. He says he's found another location, a quiet spot near a lake. He stands up and walks toward the guest suite. He tells me to get some sleep. He says we have a long drive in the morning. He stops at the door and looks back. He tells me not to forget the ledger. It's the only copy. The door clicks shut. I am alone with the blinking cursor. The radiator hisses. The sound is like a long, slow intake of breath. I reach out and touch the laptop. The plastic is warm now, heated by the processor. I look at the sentence I changed. The killer wouldn't feel the weight as a burden. He would feel it as an extension of his own arm. I delete the word killer. I replace it with I. I realize that Julian was right about one thing. I do have a dangerous imagination. I spent months thinking of ways to hide a body. I spent months researching how to bypass security cameras, how to clean a crime scene with enzymatic bleach, how to disappear into a crowd without being noticed. I did all the work. He just gave me the prompts. I look at the silver spoon in the glass of dusty water. I think about the weight of it. I think about the way a human throat is surprisingly delicate. I start to type. I don't write about the orchard. I write about the lake. I write about a man in a charcoal wool sweater who disappears during a research trip. I write about a tragic accident. I write about a ghost who finally decides to stop being a ghost. The prose is tactile. It is visceral. I describe the sound of the water hitting the shore. I describe the way the light catches on a silver spoon. The failure point was 6 months ago when I first stepped into this apartment. The success point is right now. I hear him moving in the other room. The floorboards creak. He is brushing his teeth. He is setting his watch. He is preparing for a tomorrow that I am currently rewriting. I type faster. The words flow easily now. There is no resistance. I am no longer translating his abstractions. I am creating my own reality. I am the architect. He is just the tenant. The cursor blinks. It is no longer a pulse. It is a heartbeat. I write the ending first. In the ending, the girl walks out of the woods alone. She has the ledger. She has the laptop. She has the story. And when the police ask her what happened, she will show them the confession. She will show them the handwriting. She will show them the receipts. And she will tell them, with a controlled, rational voice, that she tried to stop him. I finish the paragraph. I save the file. I pick up the brown, shriveled apple and throw it into the trash can. The sound of it hitting the plastic liner is a sharp final thud. I sit and wait for the sun to come up. The street lights go out, one by one. The gray light of morning begins to fill the room, erasing the shadows. The apartment looks different in the dawn. It looks smaller. It looks like a stage where the play has already ended. Julian opens the door. He is dressed for the drive. He looks at me and asks if I'm ready. I stand up. I pick up the ledger. I feel the weight of it in my hand. It doesn't feel like a burden. It feels like an extension of my arm. I tell him I'm ready. We walk toward the elevator. The hallway is silent. The carpet muffles our footsteps. As the doors slide open, I see our reflection in the polished brass. We look like a team. We look like two people with a secret. He steps in first. I follow him. The doors close. The descent begins. I think about the lake. I think about the water. I think about how easy it is to drown when you're convinced you're the one who knows how to swim. The elevator reaches the lobby. The bell chimes. I step out into the light.